Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the psychology and personalities of political life. Politics used to be described as show business for ugly people, which spoke perhaps to the observation that people went into politics not just to help other people and make the country better, but for fame, for riches, and to appear on TV all the time. And when some MPs, like Matt Hancock, do appear to go on TV all the time, even if it's reality TV, maybe that mantra still holds good. Certainly focus groups and polling suggest that voters are increasingly unimpressed by politicians of all stripes. And more widely, not least with a general election looming, people are asking, how could we get better people into politics? To help me sift through the CVs, or perhaps more likely the theatre resumes and headshots on Spotlight, I am delighted to be joined by Deputy Editor of Conservative Home, Henry Hill. Hello, Henry.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you for coming onto my couch, as they say. what's gone wrong up until now? Why do we seem to have a collection of slightly unusual people entering politics and sometimes staying there for a very long time?
Well, I think it's a combination of factors, and it's really hard to pick them all apart. But I think a few key ones are politics is now just a much worse job being an MP than it used to be even a couple of decades ago. You know, if you think back to the 90s or the 80s, an MP had a certain esteem. There was a much more relaxed pace of life. We hadn't yet got 24-hour news, let alone social media and Twitter. The role was much more focused on being a legislator. You know, you arrived maybe around lunchtime and you sat until 3 a.m. going through bills line by line. There was much more freedom to speak. You could speak as long as you liked in the House of Commons because it was set at MP's pace rather than the executive's pace. And I think all of these things have kind of come together to mean that being an MP now selects for a very different sort of person, or at least a very different appetite. Because what does being an MP look like now? Your parliamentary role is hugely reduced. You know, most sort of popular or at least controversial bills are programmed. So the government sets a fixed amount of time for the debate. And then you see that absurd spectacle of the speaker cutting speeches to 3 minutes and then to 2 minutes. Some MPs don't get to speak at all, which would have seemed ridiculous a generation ago. You're doing vast amounts of casework, which is often stuff that you can't actually affect, but you're sending letters to local councillors and health boards and other people. And then you're subject to the social media goldfish bowl. And you might not be famous. You know, I don't know how many people could name all 650 MPs in Parliament, but there only needs to be a small number of people who are really obsessed with you and what you're doing to hugely impact your day-to-day life. So I think it's a combination of all of those factors.
Although, of course, some of those 650 do then elevate themselves through their personalities to being household names. And obviously, we don't just have to think about Boris Johnson, but there are many who do seem to be loving the limelight, loving the performance. We've got David Lammy has got a radio show, Ed Vasey has a radio show, Nigel Farage has a TV show. You know, they're all in the broadcast media. Is it that we have to get away from those kinds of people, the performers in life?
Well, it's fascinating because also you didn't even list any of the Conservative MPs who have television shows. I think GB News alone is going to have a roster of four pretty soon. Yeah. Esther and Phil have the double act. Jacob Rees-Mogg has a show 4 nights a week. Lee Anderson, there we go. He's about to get one as well. I wouldn't be surprised if Boris Johnson ended up getting one. So yeah, it's a definite trend. But I think the question is, how do you get away from it? Because ultimately, as I said in a recent piece on Conholme, to an extent, we get the political class we deserve, right? We demand endless transparency, you know, everything from cameras in the Commons to they work for you to all of that. We demand performance, and then we complain when we get performers. And I think the press and the journalists need to hold their hands up to this as well. You know, I was talking on another podcast actually earlier today.
There are other podcasts.
There are There are, shockingly, there are none as great as and elevated as this one. But we're talking about the decline of the, it was a media one, and we were talking about the decline of the old-fashioned long-form discursive interview, political interview, the real substantive stuff. And I think the reason for that is, in the old days, that interview went out live, and then it was written up in tomorrow's papers. And both of those meant that it got a fairly fair treatment, right? You either watched the whole thing or you read an informed analysis of it. Whereas now, what's going to happen is that a section of that, if they even happened, a section of that interview would be clipped. That clip would go on the news, and that clip, or more than one clip, would also go on social media. And that would be all that most people saw of it. And I think that's why you end up with this intensely frustrating message discipline from the MPs who don't blow themselves up. Whatever you ask them, they'll always pivot back to whatever it is they want to be talking about. Is that good for journalism? Is that good for public information? No, it's not. But there is a reason that they do it. And that reason has a huge amount to do with the structure of the media and how we scrutinize politicians. So unless we were prepared to change that, and I don't immediately see that we are prepared to change any of that, we are going to keep selecting for good performers.
And are we also going to have to increasingly select, given that you've mentioned social media, people who have got the hide of a rhinoceros to deal with the intense trolling and the abuse and the misogyny and all the other horrendous things that come with having a public platform?
Yeah, I think we are. And again, thick skin is the good iteration of that. But a certain degree of shamelessness is another way that you can cope with this kind of thing. There's maybe a recent prominent blonde-haired example of somebody who managed to go quite far using that particular mindset. But yeah, absolutely. And again, it's tricky because most people who reach out to their MP, they aren't abusive. And they do think that it's good that, MPs are more accessible. You can now contact them on Twitter and so on and so forth. But it does empower a sort of vicious, spiteful minority to really make MPs' lives miserable. And I think that one, that is putting good people off standing. And two, you can see it in the fact that the parliamentary careers are getting shorter. It used to be that being an MP was a vocation, right? You went in slightly later in life and then you broadly stayed there. And often you died there. Whereas now, the average length of a parliamentary career now, I think, is 3 terms, which means you have people coming in and maybe becoming a minister, maybe not, and then leaving. Now, that has huge implications for the institutional memory of the House of Commons. There's fewer elder statesmen and women and people who know their way around the block. And that's challenging as well. But again, I don't think any of the solutions are popular because politicians are held in very low esteem. And if ever you propose, well, maybe we should give them more privacy, maybe there should be a little less transparency, maybe we should even pay them a bit more money, you're never going to get it. I've never got a favorable response when I've floated this in any kind of public setting. But if we don't, then that kind of general attitude of public contempt is corrosive to the kind of people we get in public life, because ultimately we'll only get the people who are prepared to put up with it.
To your point about people perhaps only staying for a limited period of time, what was your view then on David Cameron resigning after the Brexit vote and then just leaving political life, to not staying around to be a grandee and as you talk, to have that to contribute to the collective political memory within the House or in the upper chamber? That actually, was that not a good thing to be able to say, actually, you know what, there is more to life than politics, and I do have a lovely family and I want to spend time with them and do different things. That actually, is it a good thing that we now don't have people who see politics as just the be all and end all?
I mean, on a personal level, to some extent, I really did respect it, right? Because working in Westminster, you do meet a lot of people for whom the bubble is their life. And as someone who has tried until at least very recently to have a complete church and state approach to working in Westminster and my social life, like I, it's good that he had that ability to step back. But I think it's bad that he felt that overwhelming need to choose between the two. And I don't think that a generation ago he would have done. Now, there are specific political things about calling a referendum and then having no plan for if you lost and then immediately resigning, but that's all politics. But if we're talking about this kind of the merits of him staying on, I think in a previous age, he could have gone to the back benches. I don't know how many newspaper columns would ever have been written about him. And then after the election, perhaps he could have gone to the House of Lords, and he could have had his private life, and he could have intervened in Lords debates and all the rest of it, and maybe even, as was talked about at one point, come back and served as in some other capacity. And I think there was a lot more scope for people to do that then, whilst also mostly having their private life. Whereas now, there is, you know, online copy is free, right? There's no page limit. Everyone has a camera. It's much more easier to scrutinize people's private lives than ever before. And so I think he did feel that kind of hard choice between continuing to participate in some form and going back to enjoy his private life. Previous generations, you know, the phrase we use is hinterland, right? You had a generation of politicians who had hinterlands and interests outside of politics, and they managed to combine that with long careers of political service. And I think it's sad that increasingly people like Sajid Javid seem to view coming into parliament as an interregnum. It's something that they do full time for a while, and then they leave.
Unless their ambitions aren't thwarted. I mean, presumably, if things had gone differently for Sajid Javid, he might have stayed on. I can't imagine
I don't imagine he would have stepped down if he had won the Conservative leadership election and was currently prime minister. That's true. But you know, how many people does that ever pan out for? And I think it is significant that, given that he didn't, and given the circumstances he found himself in, that this man who has held so many of the great offices of state didn't feel that staying in politics was compatible with stepping back from the front line and going and enjoying more of a private life, going back into private practice and business. I think it's a significant change, I think.
And you mentioned earlier that maybe a generation or so ago, and prior to that, the conduct of business would have been so different, with maybe sittings going on into the early hours of the morning and scrutiny being much more intense. But actually, presumably, there were changes made to the working environment specifically to encourage more people to come into Parliament, so that we could, for example, have better working hours, that people could have Westminster could champion a better work-life balance. And that is surely a good thing. I wonder why that's not attracting more people to be able to say, actually, it's a good place to work.
I mean, I actually don't agree with that framing. It was certainly the spin that Robin Cook put on those reforms. But you read Chris Mullin's diaries, who was one of the big critics of these proposals. And realistically, what MPs were doing was voting to cut their own working hours. Now, the fact is that being a legislature has certain requirements, and you can't just shoehorn that into whatever sitting hours you happen to want to sit. What we've seen since the advent of programme motions and the much shorter sitting hours is actually the House of Commons' scrutineering role is much reduced. Far more of the slack is taken up by the House of Lords. They have to do an awful lot more work sort of patching and mending legislation than they used to. We've also seen power flowing out from Parliament to regulators, and previously to the European Union and others. And we also have, I think, what is just a fundamentally undemocratic or democratically problematic model, where on a really important bill where lots of MPs want to speak, people's elected representatives can not be allowed to because there isn't time. That's a fundamental change in the role of MP. And I think it's suborning the actual function of an MP and the actual job, which in my view should come first, to a conception of how from the outside the life of an MP ought to look on a timetable. And also, you know, fundamentally, most MPs' families, for all that it's described as family-friendly hours, most MPs' families aren't in London.
Well, they don't live in London, exactly. So you can't just nip down the Northern Line and tuck your children in bed at night.
No, precisely. So I think it would have been better if we had... I understand the need for MPs to spend more time with their families. That would have been absolutely fine. But I think that given where most MPs live, the way you do that is actually you have a more intense but shorter week. Maybe you completely wrap up business earlier, but you do have those late sittings. And then you give MPs 3 days a week in their constituency where nearly all of their families actually live. And that would have been a better compromise. But as it is, fundamentally, Parliament is just not that attractive because you are still making huge sacrifices. You're spending 3 or 4 days a week, often away from your family. That huge sacrifice is still there. And tweaks to sitting hours don't change that.
Well, before we finally come on to some other of your solutions, I was also just thinking about some of the behaviour of some of our politicians that we've witnessed actually only this year, in the last 12 months maybe. We've had Dominic Raab's alleged bullying, which he denies. We've had Boris in the Privileges Committee. We've had an SNP MP suspended over COVID rule breaking. Very recently, we've had David Warburton resigning over drugs and sex allegations, new charges of sexual misconduct against a couple of Labour MPs. Is it something about the nature of politics, or the fact that once you're in politics, you have this aura of power around you? Does that change people so much that actually it wouldn't matter who we got in? Fundamentally, there will always be people who will actually start to change for the worse.
That is true to an extent. It is a really unique working environment, not just working in Parliament, but working in politics. You have far more than I think in other industries. You have huge age ranges. You have very strange working hours. You basically got a kind of hothouse effect where lots and lots of people are kind of packed into a building, and then there's a constellation of nearby clubs and bars and so on. And there's a lot of temptation. And I think that there are people who, exposed to that, become people who they would not have become had they not been exposed to that. That's certainly true. But and we shouldn't mythologize the past again, but one of the upsides of living in a more transparent era is that it is easier for this kind of stuff to come out. You know, maybe a generation ago, an awful lot of these stories that we're discussing would have been in the Chief Whip's little black book, and it would have been keeping people in line, and instead it's come out. And there is much good to that, it has to be said. But yes, it's a bit like, I guess one comparison I would make is to something like banking. You know, high level banking or law also has insane hours and makes huge demands of people. And that can sometimes push people off the rails as well. There are challenges to this kind of environment. But fundamentally, being an MP can't be a 9-to-5 job. There is simply too much that an MP needs to do in terms of being a legislator and passing good law for that to happen.
So how do we deal with that high octane environment and attract the right kind of people? Ultimately, finally, what would your solutions be?
So there are a few. I mean, one, I would increase the money. It's wildly unpopular, but when you compare to some of the salaries that really the good people can make in the private sector, I know MPs earn quite a lot compared to Britain, which is a low-wage country fundamentally. But you could pay them a lot more money. And there are also smaller things. This one is always unpopular, but I stand by it, which is I would repeal the ban on MPs employing their spouses as staff. Because fundamentally, if you're in one of these, if you're in this job, which requires you to be away from home for several nights a week, which exposes you to a huge amount of social pressure and temptation, I actually think that being able to employ your spouse, meaning one, you see your spouse a lot more than you otherwise would, and two, you've sort of got them there to act as a lodestar and a reminder of what you might be throwing away. I think that would be hugely helpful. Beyond that, I mean, it's hard to know, but if I had a magic wand, I'd ban stuff like They Work For You, which tallies up, which encourages MPs to kind of treat Parliament like a treadmill. It is very, very hard to see how you could undo all of this without a fundamental change in our media environment. You know, we'd have to have a kind of collective decision by the press that if we had an honest long form interview with an MP and they said something stupid, we wouldn't immediately pile onto it and make that the only story that came out of that interview. Now, that's a collective action problem. Even if 99% of us agreed to do that, there'd always be one.
Yes, the gotcha moment has really trumped everything.
Yeah, it has. And I don't think it's... And ultimately, it's contributed to huge public cynicism about politics. And that's a self-reinforcing cycle, because the public dislike politicians. They therefore are deeply opposed to paying them more money, or they don't trust them, so they don't want to give them more privacy and all the rest of it. And in exchange, you end up selecting for worse politicians. And I also think, frankly, repealing some of those Cook reforms would allow MPs more chance to actually make an impact. And I think that's the other thing. You know, the three things you could possibly pick, or that Adam Hawksby picked in a recent piece for City AM, are fame, power, and money, right? Now, all of those sound bad in the abstract, but the power to change things is what politics is. And I think the fact that so many backbench MPs end up stuck on this casework treadmill, which is basically just forwarding work from local councillors to other bodies, and they don't have the ability to make an impact in Parliament that they might have done in the past, is another thing which makes people who might otherwise have been tempted by a career in politics go, actually, even if I do want to make a difference, I have a better chance of doing that in the private sector or the third sector. So I think we reform Parliament to give MPs more power. We try and find some ways to give them some more privacy, and we pay them some more money, and we let them employ their spouses so that they've always got them on hand.
Henry Hill, thank you very much indeed for being such a wonderful and also thought-provoking guest on The Couch.
Oh, well, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.